As we continue our series that we're going through this Advent season, and It's a Wonderful Life, today we want to talk about It's a Wonderful Life in the Face of Trouble. Have you ever felt like you would be better off dead than alive? You know, the struggles of life, they seem to surmount, they seem to go far beyond all the beauties of life. And you begin to wonder, what's the point? What's the use? Well, that happened to George Bailey in the classic film, It's a Wonderful Life. In the scene that we're about to show you, George, who owns the only business in town that the rich villain, Mr. Potter, hasn't taken over, and he has to go to Mr. Potter out of desperation to ask him for help. You see, Uncle Billy has lost their bank deposit, $8,000, which unbeknownst to George Bailey, Mr. Potter somehow has found, and he has his hands on it, and he's keeping it a secret. George, he is now taking responsibility for this, and he frantically needs to somehow come up with this loan from the last man that he would ever want to ask for help or to ask anything from. So let's watch.
I'm in trouble, Mr. Potter. I need help. Through some sort of an accident, my company shortened their accounts. The bank examiner got there today. I've got to raise $8,000 immediately.
Oh, that's what the reporters wanted to talk to you about.
The reporters?
Yes, they called me up today from your building and loan. Oh, there's a man over there from the DA's office, too, who's looking for you.
Please help me, Mr. Potter. Help me, won't you, please? Can't you see what it means to my family? I'll pay any sort of a bonus on the loan, any interest. If you still want the building and loan, I'm...
George, could it possibly be there's a slight discrepancy in the books?
No, sir, there's nothing wrong with the books. I've just misplaced $8,000. I can't find it anywhere.
You misplaced $8,000?
Yes, sir.
Have you notified the police?
No, sir, I didn't want the publicity. Harry's homecoming tomorrow.
Yeah, you're going to believe that, will you? What have you been doing, George? Playing the market with the company's money?
No, sir, no, sir, I haven't.
What is it, a woman, then? You know, it's all over town that you've been giving money to Violet Bick.
What?
Not that it makes any difference to me, but why did you come to me? Why don't you go to Sam Wainwright and ask him for the money?
I can't get a hold of him. He's in Europe.
Well, what about all your other friends?
Well, they don't have that kind of money, Mr. Potter. You know that. You're the only one in town that can help me.
I've suddenly become quite important. Well, what kind of security would I have, George? Have you got any stocks?
No, sir.
Bonds? Real estate? Collateral of any kind?
I have some life insurance. $15,000 policy.
Yes. How much is your equity in it?
$500.
$500? And you asked me to lend you $8,000. Look at you. You used to be so cocky. You were going to go out and conquer the world. You once called me a warped, frustrated old man. What are you but a warped, frustrated young man? Miserable little clerk crawling in here on your hands and knees and begging for help. No securities, no stocks, no bonds, nothing but a miserable little $500 equity and a life insurance policy. You're worth more dead than alive. Why don't you go to the riffraff you love so much and ask them to let you have $8,000? You know why? Because they'd run you out of town on a rail. But I tell you what I'm going to do for you, George. Since the state examiner is still here, as a stockholder of the building and loan, I'm going to swear out a warrant for your arrest. Misappropriation of funds, manipulation, malfeasance. All right, George, go ahead. Go ahead. You can't hide in a little town like this. Now, Bill, this is Potter.
Good spaghetti.
We got everything.
Voglio cantare una canzone d'amore.
God. Father in heaven, I'm not a praying man, but if you're up there and you can hear me, show me the way. I'm at the end of my rope. Show me the way, oh God.
George, in this scene, he has hit rock bottom. It doesn't get any lower than this for him. The unfairness of it all is overwhelming. George isn't the one who lost the money. Uncle Billy did. George doesn't use people. He even gave up his honeymoon money so that he could help people at one point. Mr. Potter, on the other hand, he uses everyone and everything, and now he is putting the screws to George in his plight. Mr. Potter has George's money, for goodness sake, and is even telling him about it. It certainly doesn't seem like a wonderful life. And if you know the story, you know that this is where George decides that he's going to take his own life by jumping in to the frigid waters. But let's stop. Let's think about your story. Let's think about my story. You see, life is difficult, but life is difficult. You and I know that that's true. And Christmas, it can be even more difficult. Even life in which a person strives diligently to be godly, to be helpful, to be close to God, even that includes difficulty. Now, in the scriptures, we are told that God walked with Adam and Eve. And after sin came into their hearts, God, he was still God. But for Adam and Eve, life got a whole lot more difficult. Abraham, he was the only person in all of Scripture specifically called God's friend. Handpicked by God to bring in God's blessing into the world. And still for him, life was difficult. He waited some 25 years for this promised child to be born. He was 100 when that took place. Moses, raised in a palace, used to riding in those stretched chariots. But you know the story. All the time in the wilderness, the deliverance from Egypt, roaming around through all that hot sand for all those years. Life is difficult. But, and I'm going to guess that you and I could probably share a story or two about the difficulties of life. You've been at the end of your rope. Sometimes it's because of the mud that we've created ourselves. You're so distant from your spouse that even the thought of going out on a date seems at best, well, awkward. Or maybe you've spent every penny that you have. Not on worthwhile things, but just spending it. And now you can't seem to make ends meet. The collectors are calling and they're knocking on your door. You're hungry enough to where you just can't settle your stomach. Or maybe it was in the heat of the moment, in a fit of anger, you said some words to your best friend that you're not really proud of at this very moment. The two of you, you don't really talk anymore. You don't communicate. Life is difficult. But sometimes it's because of circumstances that are beyond our control. Your house is always empty. You know, mom and dad, they always seem to be gone. You roam the halls in complete silence. Echoing in your head are the thoughts, where is everyone? Am I really important? Or maybe you've moved. You moved to a new place, a new town. Every street is unfamiliar to you. You go into the grocery store and you don't even know where to find the spaghetti sauce. You don't know who to call when your car won't start. There's busyness and there's bustling all around you, and yet you feel all alone. It's winter. It's colder. Several more months of gray skies, clouds, rain. You know, scraping ice and shoveling snow, shorter days, longer nights. Sometimes we call it the winter blues or the winter blues. It can even lead to a state of depression. You might find yourself becoming restless, lethargic, cranky, maybe moody, or even just down in the dumps. You know, psychologists, they even have a name for this feeling. Seasonal affective disorder or sad? How can life be wonderful? Life is difficult, but sometimes it's because of tragedy. You see, the rise of the computer age, it's changed things, and nobody wants to buy encyclopedias anymore. Or maybe the kind of car that your company sells, or any number of other things. Everyone's doing it online and things like that. And so your company, your business goes out of business. The rise of skin cancer. It claims the life of your grown child, a young mother herself. And as a young mother, she leaves behind her husband and two kids, who because of their grief, sometimes feel like dying themselves. Just because it's the holiday season, you know, Advent or Christmas, doesn't mean that we find life to be joyful and wonderful. In the Christmas classic that we're using, It's a Wonderful Life, this is exactly the way that George Bailey is feeling. In fact, often the expectations of celebrating, of family getting together, of joyful songs, of giving, it actually serves to accent for some of us that we don't really have all that. That life is not so wonderful. We have difficulties and we struggle, but we're not the first people to discover that. Did you know that Judah felt its share of gloom? In Isaiah chapter 7, verses 1 through 17, which is our scriptures that we're going to go through this morning, it says this: when Ahaz, son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, was king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram, and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower it. Now the house of David was told, Aram has allied itself with Ephraim. So the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken, as the trees of the forest were shaken by the wind. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out, you and your son Shear Jashub, to meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the launderer's field. Say to him, be careful, keep calm, and don't be afraid. Do not lose heart because of these two smoldering stubs of firewood. Because of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and of the son of Remaliah, Aram and Ephraim and Remaliah's son have plotted your ruin, saying, let us invade Judah. Let us tear it apart and divide it among ourselves and make the son of Tabael king over it. Yet this is what the sovereign Lord says. It will not take place. It will not happen. For the head of Aram is Damascus. And the head of Damascus is only Rezin. Within 65 years, Ephraim will be too shattered to be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria. And the head of Samaria is only Remaliah's son. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, ask the Lord your God for a sign, whether in the deepest depths or in the highest heights. But Ahaz said, I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test. Then Isaiah said, hear now, you house of David, is it not enough to try the patience of human? Will you try the patience of my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and you will call him Emmanuel. He will be eating curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. For before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and to choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid to waste. The Lord will bring on you and your people and on the house of your father a time unlike any other since Ephraim broke away from Judah. He will bring the king of Assyria. Okay, I got to break away from all this. How many of you knew that chapter 7, verse 14, and a virgin shall conceive a son and stuff was stuck in the middle of all of that? Most of us don't. We know that one verse and we read it. See, in the context of this whole text that we're looking at this morning, there are 10 Hebrew tribes and Aram have joined them. And they're about to make war against Judah. And Judah is the two tribes of the Hebrew tribes. They're the line of David. So all these young boys are starting to put their camo on. They're getting their gear together. They're getting ready to go out and fight in the fields. The mothers are at home with worry. They're chewing their fingernails, wondering what's going to happen through all of this. And God promises to use Assyria to wipe out Aram and Israel, those 10 tribes. And he invited Ahaz, who is the king of Judah, to believe in him, to ask him for a sign. But Ahaz won't do it. He won't ask God for a sign. And God says, okay, you don't want my encouragement? Assyria is going to conquer you as well. Life is going to be difficult. The land it won't produce. The vineyards, they will turn to thorns. Assyria is going to plunder you and leave you in waste. But I want you to see that in the midst of all of that difficulty, there are some eye-catching strands of hope, some little glimmers that come out, and verse 14 of this text I read for you is one of those glimmers of hope. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. In the next chapter, in chapter 8, at verse 8, it says, and sweep on into Judah, swirling over it, passing through it, reaching up to the neck. Its outspread wings will cover the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. A little bit farther in chapter 8 at verse 10, to the invading nations, devise your strategies, but it will be thwarted. Propose your plan, but it will not stand. For God is with us. Now here's the central truth. Here's what I want you to take from all of this today, this morning. Life is difficult, but God is with us. See, for Judah, times were about to get really bad. But that didn't mean for a single minute That all of it wouldn't filter through the loving fingers of God, our Heavenly Father. Even a nation who didn't always want God's help, they were going to have it. Even when they felt the tide of the swirling of difficulty, experiencing them and overtaking them all the way up to their heads. And God wanted them to remember that He was right there with them through all of it, never leaving them and never forsaking them. And then some 700 years later, instead of sending another angel or another prophet, God sent His Son to this blue and green orb that we call planet Earth to be born of a virgin. And in Matthew chapter 1 at verse 21, it says, "She will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins." All of this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. See, Matthew here, he sees what he want, what God wanted Ahaz and all of Judah to see and to learn. It's what he wants us to learn and to understand from Christmas. God comes to his people. God cares about your difficult life. He cares about the struggles that you're going through. God, he knows how sin has ruined you and how it has ruined me. And he is not content to let it stay that way, to let it be that way. He is doing something about it. That is exactly what the other name, you know, Jesus, that's what it means. God saves. Now, it's not explicit in this film, but the fact is, God is there, even in the film. He's watching George's life. He is, after all, the one that is telling the angel, you know, Clarence, pay close attention to this section. He hears George's prayer, and he sends an angel to help him. He is not, as George prays, and as many people think, just up there. You know, he created all this, and now he's up doing his own thing. He is here with us. The movie doesn't say it, not outright at least. But the church, it must always preach it, and we must always declare it. It's a wonderful life, because God does not leave us alone. Life is difficult, but God is with us. Do you understand what God is saying to you in this Advent season? He's saying, do not despair. I know your struggles. I know your trials. That is a part of the fallen world in which you live. Don't be surprised, but don't despair. I have not left. Peter, he puts it this way in the book of 1 Peter chapter 4. He says, "Dear friends, do not be surprised at the painful trials you are suffering as though something strange were happening to you." You see, God's a realist. God tells it just like it is. He puts it all out there. He never said it's going to be a rose garden. He never said, "Walk with me and everything's going to be easy. It's going to go your way. It's going to be a piece of cake." What he does say is, "I'll see you through. I will go with you through it, whatever it is." So let's be honest. There are things that we face in our lives. There are times when we are afraid. You're newly married, and you're thinking to yourself, "What did I get myself into? I don't have a clue with what I'm doing here." You have a friend. Your friend's in trouble, and your friend comes to you and is talking with you and is sharing with you, and you're thinking to yourself, "I don't know what to say." You're at your job, you know, the place where you're working, and you're sitting there one day and you're going, "Why'd they even bother to hire me?" You know, you watch the television or you read the news about all the wars that are taking place. The terrorist bombings, all the shootings that are taking place in the schools or in the malls all around us. Organized crime. You hear of all the different disasters that are taking place. And you're thinking to yourself, what will this world be like in 10 years from now? And you're afraid. You want to have a family, or maybe your grandkids or your great-grandkids. Thought of them having to grow up in this world and what the world's going to be like. And it seems so daunting, so overwhelming, the things that they're going to have to face and they're going to have to go through. For a moment, think of your own life, just for a moment here. Is there somewhere in your life where you just feel totally overwhelmed? Life just seems totally daunting and you feel like you're up to your neck and you don't know how to get out. Close your eyes just for a moment and listen to our Lord's voice speak into your situation. Think of that thing, whatever it is. Jesus is saying, I'm here. I'm with you. I'm still in control for you. My coming to your earth is my supreme word on it. You see, in John chapter 16 at verse 33, he said, I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart. I have overcome the world. You see, when you take whatever problem it is you have, whatever it is that's surrounding you, and it feels like it's going to swallow you up, and you look at it from the lens of Jesus, where he says, I've overcome all of that. I am with you. Then hopefully it doesn't seem so daunting. Doesn't seem so helpless. Peter, he actually goes on and he says in 1 Peter chapter 4 at verse 19, so then those who suffer according to God's will, should commit themselves to their faithful Creator and continue to do good. That's my question for you this morning. Will you commit yourself to your faithful Creator? Now, George, at the end of the clip that we're watching, as he's sitting at the bar, he says, I'm not a praying man, but God. Now, that's not really anything to be proud of, because we should be men of prayer. We should be women of prayer. Okay, we should be teens of prayer as well. Okay, we should be a congregation that is all about prayer. We want to use prayer as a last resort, but it should be the first thing that we're doing is prayer. Will we commit ourselves and turn and pray to our Maker and pray to our Savior? Ask Him to show us the way. God, I'm at the end of my rope. Will you be with me? Will you show me? Will you be with me through it? See, invite him. That is his very identity as Emmanuel, to be God with us. In Isaiah chapter 8, at the end of it, verse 22 on into chapter 9, verse 2, and then verse 6, it says, then they will look toward the earth and see only distress and darkness and fearful gloom. And they will be thrust into utter darkness. Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the future, he will honor Galilee of the nations by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. In verse 6 of chapter 9 of Isaiah, it says, for to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. In Matthew, Jesus has been crucified, he's been buried, he's resurrected. He spent the time with his disciples, his followers, and just as he's getting ready to leave and for his ascension, And in chapter 28, at verse 20, he says, "And surely I am with you always, even to the very end of the age." No matter what you're going through, God, Jesus, He is there with you. He will never leave you. He will never forsake you. You see, it is a wonderful life, even in the face of trouble, even in the face of difficulty, because of Emmanuel, God with us. No matter what happens, no matter what you're going through, no matter what you have gone through, He will never, ever let you go. You go.